So tonight's Dhamma talk is called It All Comes Down to Right View. Right view being, you might call it right understanding, is another translation. Also, you could see it as wise understanding or wholesome understanding or wholesome view. I mean, you see lots of variations on that translation, but this is the first step on the Eightfold Path. And if you're going to take a path, the first step better be in the right direction. It better be on the path, right? I want to read several things that people say about that. And this is Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about sort of what disturbs us sometimes, why we don't have right view, perhaps. Truth discerning wisdom also comes into play when we find ourselves caught in major storms of afflictive emotions or simply acting out our basic personality tendencies. In these situations, Ajahn Chah is reminded that there are two kinds of suffering. One that leads to more suffering, and one that leads to its end. I think that's great. It's like, oh, you're going to have suffering. So may as well make sure that the suffering you're going through is going in the right direction, right? Can prompt the arising of the discernment of Dhamma. Instead of getting lost in and acting out habitual patterns of suffering in times of emotional turbulence, we can first investigate what is actually going on, that is the nature of the emotion itself, and then see how we are relating to that emotion. Are we claiming it to be I or mine? Is what this story that we're getting caught in just creating more of a sense of a separate self? Sometimes a simple act of clear recognition is enough to come to a place of acceptance and letting go. Instead of being tossed around in the storm of undifferentiated emotions, we can begin to discern whether our emotions is fear or loneliness, boredom or unhappiness. Clarity of discernment through investigation of dhammas can bring acceptance because we are aligning ourselves accurately with the present moment experience. We're going in the right direction. We're aligning ourselves, right? It's a way of acknowledging, yes, this is what's here. From this place of acceptance, we can then see more clearly the impermanent, selfless nature of the emotion and free ourselves from identifying with it, letting go by letting be. Just let it be. Don't have to go there. Don't have to get involved with it. So that's a sort of a philosophical view, in a sense. Then we have this is Ryokan, Zen poet, 16th, 17th century. Very pithy. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? Make sure you're heading in the right direction. It's like pretty simple. That's what right view is all about. So making sure we're heading in the right direction. And then this is from Ajahn Sumedho. The first of the eight factors in the Eightfold Path is right view, which develops from having seen and experienced cessation. To have right view requires that we are mindful all the time. We must know that everything arises and passes away is not self, and this must be a direct experience, an insight. Right view is based on direct, insightful knowing, not just thinking and believing in the concept. As long as you don't really know but just think you know, you will always be in a state of uncertainty and be confused. This is because intellectual knowing is based on symbols alone, not on direct experience of truth. So this is a pretty strong statement he's making here. And I think it's important to point out that, yes, what he's saying is absolutely true, but it takes a while. And we go through cycles. You know, we often think of the Eightfold Path as a path, like path goes somewhere, right? Actually, the Eightfold Path is circular. And, you know, we started at some point, for some reason we started on this path. Something happened, we read something, someone told us something, we heard a Dharma talk, whatever. We read a book. And we went, yes, I want to go there. And we had a certain view that we'd adopted, some sort of wholesome view that encouraged us to start out. And then we, you know, went through the other steps and we started, you know, getting our life together in the world, and then we sort of finally, you know, developed some concentration. And then at a certain point we go, oh, that view I had back there at the beginning, it's becoming refined. And we sort of step back and look at our wholesome view, our right view again, and we see that it has a different quality to it, because now it's based partly on just the ideas and partly based on what we're actually experiencing as we practice. And over time, we go through that cycle several times, you know, rinse and repeat, as they say, and we will eventually get to a clearer right view as he describes it. That's the idea, anyway. But it's a progressive thing, and we keep coming back and getting a clearer, more precise right view over time. So, the real question is, what happens if we aren't mindful? As Ajahn Sumedho says, we have to be mindful all the time, without exception, with always mindful. What if we're not always mindful? What if we get caught up in views that are unwholesome, that are leading us in the wrong direction, might even be leading us backwards, who knows? And there's this very famous sutta, which is part of what I wanted to talk about tonight. And this is it's the Salyaka Sutta, the Brahmins of Sala. So it's just, you know, in many of the suttas are places where the Buddha has been wandering and is stopped, and a bunch of people, typically Brahmins, have gathered to hear him teach. And in this case, the Brahmins were saying, basically, how can we make sure that we are leading a wholesome life, a good life? And in their case, they were thinking, because in the Brahmin view, they were going to come back, and they want to make sure they came back in a good place. They didn't want to come back in some place that was less than what they already had. They wanted to come back in something even better. You know, they want to advance in the process. And so they were saying, well, how can we make sure that happens? And the Buddha answers this way. He says, householders, listen and attend closely to what I have to say. Yes, venerable sir, they replied, of course. Householders, there are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. Unrighteous conduct. There are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. Unrighteous comment. There are three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. Unrighteous conduct. And so basically what the Buddha is saying is, if you don't act, speak in a righteous way, then you're not heading in the right direction. Right? And then the first thing I want to notice, it's interesting, always struck me, you know, he lists these 10 things. This teaching is called the 10 Unwholesome Acts of Body, Speech, and Mind. And it always fascinated me, and still does, that of the 10, 4 of them are just about speech. Like, speech is a huge issue in the Buddha's teachings, because it's where we can quickly go off the rails. We can quickly go off in the wrong direction. But then, let's look at, he then has a more precise things here. And how householders are three kinds of bodily conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. Here someone kills living beings. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. He takes what is not given. He takes by way of theft the wealth and property of others in the village or forest. He misconducts himself in sensual pleasures. It goes on and describes that in much more detail, but we'll skip that part. So here it is. This is like, it's a pretty classic list, right? Don't kill. Don't harm. But it's like, notice what he's saying here. You know, they're given to blows. They're merciless to living beings. So he's talking about not just physical violence, but violence of any sort. And then he has, you know, taking what isn't offered, and being greedy, theft, taking what doesn't belong to you. And then the last one is, you know, avoiding sexual misconduct, which I'm not going to go into at all, other than to say that you all have a pretty good understanding of that, I suspect, of what that means. And it really comes down to not causing any harm through sensual activity. Not causing harm. And you have to think of that in the broadest sense as well. Then he goes on. And how householders are there four kinds of verbal conduct, not in accordance with the Dhamma. Here, someone speaks falsehood. When summoned to a court, or to a meeting, or to his relative's presence, or to his guild, or to the royal family's presence, and questions as a witness, thus, Sokurman, tell me what you know. Not knowing, he says, I know. Or knowing, he says, I don't know. Not seeing, he says, I see. Or seeing, he says, I do not see. In full awareness, he speaks falsehood for his own ends, or for another's ends, or for some trifling worldly end. It's interesting to think about that, because, you know, we all think, oh, I'm never like that. But sometimes it's like, it's so easy just to sort of slide things a little bit. Right? So it's something, if we're going to be conscious of this, we have to be quite conscious of it. Then he goes on. He speaks maliciously. He repeats elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these. Or repeats to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, a speaker of words that create discord. Does it sound like our current political world? And I'm not taking any sides here. This is certainly on both sides of that world. At least, maybe there's more than two sides even, but it's like, this is what the speech is like these days. And then he goes on. He speaks harshly. He utters such words as are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive to others, bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. Interesting combination of words. Bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. How can you be concentrated when you're angry? Because when you're angry, your mind is in great turmoil. It's impossible to concentrate. He's a gossip. He speaks at the wrong time. Speaks what is not fact, speaks what is useless, speaks contrary to the Dhamma and the discipline. At the wrong time, he speaks such words as are worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. It's an interesting list too, huh? Like, it's like, how often is our speech not falling into that one? That talking about things that are worthless or immoderate or unbeneficial. It's easy to fall into that. Gossip is so attractive, and it's a form of that, right? And then I think what is the most interesting one is the mind. He says, and how householders are the three kinds of mental conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma. Here, someone is covetous. He covets the wealth and property of others thus. May what belongs to another be mine? Or he has a mind of ill will and intentions to hate thus. May these beings be slain and slaughtered. May they be cut off, perish, or be annihilated. So, ill will, and the Dhammapada actually has an interesting little tidbit here from this is from the Dhammapada. And he's talking very precisely about ill will and how we often fall into ill will. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. Isn't that great advice? So simple. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. And he goes on. Or he has wrong view, distorted vision thus. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good or bad actions. No this world, no other worlds, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who of themselves are realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. Wrong view. It's like he's saying all these things that we get caught up in thinking are true that aren't. That we develop, you know, a belief in something that when we see it more closely, we go, oh, how could I ever have thought that? How could I ever have believed that? It doesn't make sense. And it's often these sort of existential questions of like, you know, how did the world begin and how does it end? And we come up with some idea of how it must be, and we believe it. It becomes something that's substantial, that becomes part of who we are because I believe that particular story. And when you think about that, when you think about view as being, you know, wrong view being one of the 10 of this long list of all these other things, it's when you start to see these things more clearly, when you start to sort of see how they all fit together, it's interesting. First, there's this little bit from the Dhammapada again. I love this. This is another of those verses that just strikes me. A fool with a sense of his foolishness is at least to that extent wise. But a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. How often are our views foolish? You know, a fool with a sense of his foolishness is at least to that extent wise. At least At least I know I'm being foolish, right? But a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. I love the Dhammapada because it has these little pithy bits. You know? So the thing about this list of 10, however, is that everything is, all of these things are like many Buddhist lists, right? It's like, oh, here's 10 things. But actually, they're so interrelated and interspersed. So, for instance, unwholesome acts of body will lead to unwholesome acts of speech. You know, lying to cover up your wrongdoing, gossiping or boasting about what you got away with. Isn't that interesting how I got away with something and then you people boast about it? Yeah. Or just feeling you had, you see, oh, that wasn't very skillful what I just did. Make sure no one knows. And then that's often why we lie, because we don't want people to know that we were unwholesome, that we screwed up. We'd rather tell a little lie to protect our reputation. And we do it in the sense of, oh, I'm trying to protect my family or protecting the people around me from, you know, we'll come up with all kinds of great excuses, right? You know, and covetousness, you know, the mental idea of coveting something leads to taking what isn't offered. If I think about it, you know, oh, I really would like to have such and such a thing because everybody else seems to have such and such a thing. Before you know it, if you're not careful, now you're acting in ways that lead you to get that thing, whatever it is, that you coveted. The mental process leads to the physical act. And then to lying about the fact that you did it probably too. So a triple whammy. Ill will can arise when you feel you have had to protect yourself from people who say you've acted or spoken in an improper manner, even when you have. Yeah. Oh, you know, this will lead to harsh speech. Speech things like, well, you did it too. You know, like two little kids on the playground. But we turn into little kids on the playground sometimes. It's like, well, everybody, you know, it's like, You're saying that I shouldn't have done that, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I've seen you do something just like that or something worse, probably something worse, right? That's where the mind goes. It goes into that energy. And wrong view, and this is where wrong view is the root of all these others. Wrong view makes us believe it's okay to act and speak and think in unwholesome ways. And my title, it all comes down to wrong view. You know, we get into this place where we go, well, everybody does this. Or, you were rude or mean to me, so it's okay if I be rude or mean back. That's a wrong view. You know, and but then we act on that. And so, well, I don't want to spend any more time on this because I'm sure this list and varieties and various forms of those are familiar to all of you. You know, you've all had to look at these things. But what I'm pointing to is it takes practice to develop wholesome view. It takes practice, which means, you know, we're acting and speaking in an unwholesome way, and then we're mindful at some point, oh, that wasn't very skillful. And then we go back and we develop a clearer, wholesome view of how we should act in the world or speak in the world or think, for that matter. And that shifts the potential. The next time a similar situation arises, we go, oh, but right view says. So we're always going back to right view just to help us make decisions on how we speak and act in the world. It all comes down to right view. And And it's so easy to, you know, well, just this one time it'll be okay. It's another form of unwholesome thought, not correct view. And then there's this interesting thing in the sutta here. This is when at the very end of the sutta. This is what the Buddha says. He's talking to the Brahmins again. If, when one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct should wish, or that by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I might here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. It is possible that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he will here and now enter and abide upon in the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom with the destructions of the taints. Why is that? Because he observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma. Led a virtuous life. Right view creates the basis for everything else. Creates the basis for everything else. So then the question arises. You know, I mean, what the Buddha is saying is we need to abandon these 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And it's sort of like we can sort of see, well, I can see that the other ones, you know, I can understand at some sort of emotional level that all that list of all the things, you know, that were he put in that list, you know, not speaking harshly and various things like that. They all sort of make sense. But what about right view? How do I develop an understanding of right view? And interestingly enough, there's another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha has this one sentence that when I read this one sentence, I went, ah, here's how to develop right view. So it isn't like just the Buddha doesn't just say, have right view. Get over it. Get it together. He actually gives very specific advice. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. An interesting list, huh? Right view is assisted by, in other words, your right view becomes clearer, assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. So what's he saying here? So virtue, that's what we've been talking about all for the last quite a while. But then learning is actually pointing to the fact that studying the Dhamma, studying the teachings of the Buddha, sometimes, you know, we'll read something, and it might be like actually reading something from the Sutta, or it might be, you know, reading some commentary or like something that Joseph has said or one of the other teachers of the lineage have said. And you read it and you go, ah, never thought of it quite that way before. That's why we study. And it might be because you're reading something, it might be something you're just sitting listening to a Dharma talk. And, you know, most of the Dharma talk you're going, yeah, 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 yeah. But then someone says something and you go, oh. Yeah. Sometimes, I always often said, if I give a Dharma talk and one sentence means something to someone, I've done a good job. That's all it takes. One good sentence and someone going, ah, you know, that's what I can, you know, so just learning and study is important. And then the next one is discussion. It's the importance of Sangha. What can you, discussion means you can have times when you speak with others of like interest who are trying to develop the same form of right view that you're trying to develop. You can sort of discuss what you're studying, discuss what you heard in this Dharma talk, discuss what's going on in your mind with people who will understand what you're talking about because they're thinking about it and talking about it too. And and that's another time when, you know, someone will say something just in this sort of round robin discussion sort of way. And you've been thinking about something in one total way, and it might be a perfectly valid way to look at things, a perfectly valid view, except that someone else says something and you go, oh, isn't that interesting? It's a totally different way of looking at the same thing. And that sometimes that clarifies your own view through discussion. It's a way of clarifying what you understand. Then, so that's the first three. Then there's serenity. Just doing whatever you can to lead a life where there's stillness and calmness more often. Serenity. This is hard to do in our culture because our culture is all about being frenetic and busy. Right? Can you consciously start finding more and more time to just be still? And it doesn't have to be like some big spiritual awakening moment. It's just like, oh, I think I'll just sit on this bench in my garden and look at the flowers and watch the birds. Or look at the clouds. Clouds are fascinating. When you start to really look at, I mean, this, maybe it's my art brain, but it's like, it's just so, there's so much just to see. If you just sit still and look and listen to the sound of the birds and the wind in the trees and all those things that are going on all the time, it's so easy to find a place of serenity. So it doesn't have to be like some deep, huge thing. It's just like, okay, I'm choosing to do this as opposed to something that's sort of more active and frenetic. Not that we shouldn't be active. It's still good to get exercise every day and all those sorts of things. I'm not saying we should just sit still all the time. But it's so easy to fall into a space of, I should be doing something all the time. I can't just sit here and look at the birds. how can I do that? But just sitting there looking at the birds might be the most useful thing you did all day. Just having that quiet, serene time. Because it creates calmness and stillness of mind, which is conducive to the last one, which, of course, is insight, practice. Actually, consciously practicing the Dhamma in whatever form that practice takes. Whether it's, through meditation or through walking practice, whatever, there's lots of different ways you can practice. You can practice mindfulness, you can practice metta, for instance. But actually having a conscious time frequently, every day, maybe longer times from time to time, and a day long, or going and sitting in a sangha for a couple of hours, or doing a longer retreat. Consciously choosing to practice for longer periods of time, over time. Because that helps, that the stillness that arises in the mind from that sort of practice, whether it's just regular daily practice or longer practice, tends to clarify your view. You start to have moments of insight and go, oh. You start to see things not intellectually, all that study and discussion was all intellectual. But now we're seeing things and we actually see something arising and it's there for a while and it's gone. And we didn't react to it at all. And we're going, oh, look, This is the power of the mind, to not get caught up in having to, rant to somebody because they said something, or so-and-so, some politician, something, and now I have to rant to all my friends over coffee or whatever. No, I don't need to do that anymore. We see that really clearly, not as an intellectual understanding, but as a felt experience. And that clarifies our view even more. So this, it all comes down to right view, and right view keeps changing, and we keep going deeper and seeing more clearly over time by practicing this list: virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, insight. These are the right views assisted by these. That's the phrasing the Buddha uses. And it's assisted. It doesn't solve it, but these are things that are conducive to right view forming and becoming clearer and clearer over time. That's all we can hope for. I'll just finish with a little Dana Falls poem here. Called Let It Go. Let go of the ways you thought life would unfold, the holding of plans or dreams or expectations. Let it all go. Save your strength to swim with the tide. The choice to fight what is here before you now will only result in struggle, fear, and desperate attempts to flee from the very energy you long for. Let go. Let it all go and flow with the grace that washes through your days, whether you receive it gently or with all your quills raised to defend against invaders. Take this on faith. The mind never finds the explanations that it seeks. I want to repeat that again. Take this on faith. The mind may never find the explanations that it seeks, but you will move forward nonetheless. Let go, and the wave's crest will carry you to unknown shores, beyond your wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go, and find a place of rest and peace and certain transformation. So that's what I have to share with you tonight.